Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we look at how one Catholic university in the Holy Land is offering a window of hope to students who cannot get out of Gaza. And doubts about the war in Iraq are leading some U.S. soldiers to think twice about their role there. But first, Pope Benedict says there are three phases to love. A look at his message to young people ahead of World Youth Day. Let's listen. Pope Benedict has released his message for the 22nd World Youth Day, which will be celebrated in parishes across the world on Palm Sunday. The Pope proposes the words of Jesus in the Gospel of St. John as the theme of his reflection this year. Just as I have loved you, you should also love one another. Emer McCarthy has more.
In his message to the world's youth, Pope Benedict XVI returns to a theme which has marked his pontificate, love, and the modern misunderstanding of what it really is. He opens his message inviting young people to accompany him on a journey of discovery of love, which he himself defines as having three distinct stages: finding the source of love, revealing love, and giving love. Echoing the words of his first encyclical, the Pope reminds us that there is only one source of true love, and that is God. He says that even though the signs of divine love are already clearly present in creation, the full revelation of God's love came to us in Christ, while the manifestation of divine love is total and perfect in the cross. Pope Benedict says the cross, for the world a folly, for many believers a scandal, is in fact the wisdom of God. It is where Christ takes upon himself the sins of the world and eradicates hatred from the heart of humankind, bringing about a true revolution of love. In his message, Pope Benedict applies the theological to the practical. In a further three passages, he explains how the spiritual meaning of love is applied to everyday reality. Love, he writes, is the only force capable of changing the human heart by making fruitful the relationships between men and women, between rich and poor, between cultures and civilizations. I'm Emer McCarthy.
The conflict between Fatah and Hamas has kept the people of Gaza indoors for days on end, between repeated and failed ceasefires. Besides the casualties they've inflicted on each other, Palestinian rival groups have inadvertently killed numerous civilians. And while Palestinians are facing growing internal divisions, the pressure is perhaps most keenly felt in Gaza, where residents call themselves imprisoned in a small strip of land, cut off from the rest of the Palestinian territories and ending in the sea. Gisha, the Center for the Legal Protection of Freedom of Movement, has published a report charging that since the 1967 war, the Israeli military has developed an elaborate system of rules and sanctions to check the movement of Gaza's 3.4 million inhabitants. In its January 2007 report, the Israeli Human Rights Group says, despite its withdrawal from the Strip, the Israeli military effectively maintains control of all access into and out of Gaza, including its ports and airspace. The clampdown, Gisha says, has meant limited deliveries of food, medical and other supplies, and mechanical equipment, and even limits to electricity. It also means Gazans cannot easily leave the territory to look for jobs elsewhere to turn around the skyrocketing unemployment. Most families in Gaza cannot survive without aid from international charities. But one Catholic university has been trying to get around the mobility problem, opening a window of hope, bringing its courses to students in Gaza using the latest information technology. Bethlehem University is run by the Christian Brothers. Vice Chancellor Brother Daniel Casey told me more about the program.
We targeted Gaza for occupational therapy. The government of Norway is solidly behind the program, and every graduate through the International Occupational Therapy Association, that in addition to the university degree, they're certified as occupational therapists. So they can go anywhere in the world and be hireable because the degree is certified.
What exactly is an occupational therapist?
Well, it could be, for example, in Gaza, people who are wounded in gunfire and violence and limbs and so on. You know, walking again, using their hands, using their arms, if they've lost a limb.
So in other words, it's a training course to help people who have a physical handicap or disability to learn new occupations, new jobs.
And it could be someone with a stroke, you know, trying to do that. So Gaza has one certified occupational therapist. So we started with a class of 10. And they were not permitted passes to come to Bethlehem University.
Now, who would they have to ask those passes from?
At that time, it was the Israeli government because Gaza was part of Israel. It was controlled. And even when the Prime Minister Sharon withdrew, the permission to travel remained the same. So it was denied. They can't travel. So through the Norwegian government, we brought the faculty to them in concentrated periods of time. They'd get down for 4 or 5 days, both expatriate staff and Palestinian staff.
And so you actually had a little, some sort of a classroom area.
Yeah, we used the British Council facilities in Gaza City. Then the staff couldn't get in at all. That was forbidden. Security, safety. Israel decided that. So that's when we started using the teleconference for a number of classes, and that was successful. The technology worked. They had a good teleconference facility in Gaza City. And then for the practical aspects of occupational therapy, because the students need actually to work with people and get practical skills, which they can't get in a classroom setting, we would go to Cairo twice a year, January and June, for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And they'd have intensive classes every single day in what we would call a practicum, in a center where there were handicapped people.
So they found it easier to get out to go to Cairo.
And that was effective. There have been problems. Like they went to Cairo in early January, January 6th. They had the two-week program. And the expatriate teacher who's the coordinator of the program on our staff, Barbara Lavin, returned. And then she reported to me that the border was closed. So no one from Egypt could enter Gaza. So the 10 students were stranded. She arranged to go back for them to go back to Cairo to the Catholic retreat house they were living in. And they waited a week, and then the border opened, and they're back in Gaza. Mm. So it's practical realities like that. We have a case in the Israeli courts that's being brought forward by an Israeli human rights group called GISHA, G-I-S-H-A. There were two young attorneys, a man and a woman. So they brought the case to the Israeli courts for our Gaza students, because the only purpose of this NGO is freedom of movement. And the case has been in the courts, I'd say, 16 months. The court tends not to rule negatively. They rule favorably, but then they refer it to the Israeli military authorities, and then it sort of dies. There's no response. I doubt very much, despite their best efforts in the legal system, whether the case will be successful.
Mm. But even if it were to be successful, how would that change the lives of these kids? They would still have to get permission at the checkpoints.
Well, that's the point, that the 10 of them would move to Bethlehem and live in one of our hostels. And they would have the experience in their fourth year and last year of university studies to be on the campus with other students. Because it has not been a full university experience for them, the isolation. Mm. I don't think that will happen. They'll get the degree, we'll have some type of graduation for them in Gaza, and then they'll be ready for employment.
Again, in Gaza, probably.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Unless the only way they could come to Bethlehem is by some devious route, they get out without anyone knowing it, which is highly unusual, but possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, tell me one thing. What other universities, institutions of higher education are available to young people in Gaza? I would imagine there are thousands of young people in Gaza of university age.
Yeah, well, they have two large universities, the Islamic University in Gaza, and I think the other is called the Gaza University. So they're full to overflowing. And out of necessity, they have to limit programs. They don't have occupational therapy. That's why we're offering it.
I see. Because one of my other questions was, of course, why would somebody prefer to go to a Bethlehem University course when they can't even get to your campus?
Yeah. And I think our alumni in Gaza, we used to have about 100 students a year, so 25 or 30 would graduate. And I think they spread the word that Bethlehem University is a good place to go to.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to the parish priest of Gaza, Father Manuel Musalem, who has called Gaza a prison surrounded on all sides, and no one is able to get in or get out. However, we are seeing a similar situation in a way with Bethlehem, although to a much lesser extent. You have the huge wall surrounding Bethlehem. How has that wall affected your faculty and students coming in and out?
Well, you'd have to understand we have two groups. We have about 1,000 students from Jerusalem and 70 or 80 faculty and staff. Their life is normal. Any restrictions they'd experience would be more being in Israel as Arabs than in Bethlehem. I think our Bethlehem students, I sense it mostly among the boys, there's a, I call it low-grade depression. The male finds the enclosure difficult, very difficult.
And how do you see that manifest itself in the young men?
Well, I met with the student leaders on Friday, and to sort of break the ice, get them relaxed, we were talking about this, that, and the other thing. And they were talking, one of the boys was talking about a birthday party for his grandmother in Jerusalem. And then I learned he couldn't get a pass to go. So I just asked the seven of them, I said, who was to Jerusalem the most recent? So the same boy raised his hand, and he said, brother, I was there 4 years ago. And I said to the other six, I said, well, when were you? Oh, it was like 8 years, nine, 10.
And it's only a 10-minute drive.
Yes. So they can't get passes, or they just don't want to be humiliated in the process of asking for the pass. We had a really, I was so annoyed, but I could do nothing about it. We had a Christian leadership workshop retreat program planned for last Easter. It was going to be in the Galilee at the German Pilgrim House, beautiful spot. So we had 60 students indicate that they would be able to go. Then we started the long process of passes, permission, and so on. And the team of faculty were hopeful. Of the 60, 58 were refused. Two were approved for 1 day. So the whole thing just
fell apart.
Fell apart. And that would be typical of movement.
I would imagine that so many of these episodes, also the violence that is going on in Gaza, elsewhere, I would imagine that your students are so angered by what they see and what is happening to their families. As a Christian institution, how do you help your students work through this anger to make something positive out of it instead of something negative?
Well, I think part of it is the educational process, whether it's the formal classrooms, the activities we have. I also think the young women, we have two-thirds young women, one-third young men. And I find that the girls are more, I find this in the United States, so it's not just Palestine. They mature more quickly. They seem more mature than young men. And my experience in the USA and in Palestine is the same. And the campus gives the students the opportunity, which would not be possible outside, for young men and women to mix in the cafeteria, in the gardens, just walking around, both Muslim and Christian. And I believe the girls have an impact on the boys and just having a bit of a more hopeful view, despite the hopelessness sometimes of the situation.
And a very warm thanks there to Vice Chancellor of Bethlehem University, Brother Daniel Casey. Recent surveys in the U.S. have shown growing disapproval of the war in Iraq, where the deadly violence shows no sign of abating. But what about the troops who are out there in Iraq, often in the front line of fire in a country where the daily bloodshed has become so ubiquitous? How difficult is it for them to carry on their mission, especially when back home public discontent with the war has grown? And more Americans are questioning whether the war is a just one. Susie Hodges has been speaking to some people who have their doubts.
We don't fire warning shots. If you move your selector lever from safe to semi, you shoot to kill.
Chilling words to be addressed to a young U.S. soldier by his commander on his arrival in Iraq. The soldier in question was Joshua Castile, who's now left the military and registered as a conscientious objector. But what are the most common reasons or set of circumstances that prompt a soldier to take that momentous decision? Experts in the field say that over the past 3 years, thousands of US troops who have been deployed in Iraq come to the realization that they no longer want to fight or be deployed there. Surveys show that many of the soldiers in this position are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Others have family or medical problems, or else have moral qualms about continuing to fight in this particular war. As a result of their experiences in Iraq, some of the men and women apply to become full-blown conscientious objectors, who refuse to participate in war in any form. Others become what is known as selective conscientious objectors. This means they refuse to fight in the Iraq War, for instance, because they believe it's an unjust war. Michael Griffin is the education director for the Catholic Peace Fellowship in Indiana, a group that supports conscientious objectors through education, counselling and advocacy. He says they are seeing a growing number of soldiers who are refusing to fight any longer in Iraq.
We are hearing from definitely more soldiers. We estimate that last year, at our office alone, we had over 1,000 phone calls. Now, many of those are people who are trying to get discharges. Perhaps they're being called up a third or a fourth time to Iraq and they have families. But an increasing number seem to be what are called conscientious objectors, those who have a moral qualm about participating in the war.
One of the most difficult and traumatic situations for any soldier to face when serving in a war is to find himself involved in the killing of innocent civilians. Michael tells us about the case of one soldier he knew who'd been ordered to open fire on an Iraqi woman at a checkpoint.
What we hear across the board is soldiers who see massive civilian casualties. And one of the soldiers who came back from Iraq and contacted us, and his unit was going to be redeployed, and he said, "I'm not going." He said, "I believe it's my human right not to kill an innocent person. And if I go back to Iraq, even with good things that we do in Iraq, I know that it will involve killing innocent people." Another man we worked with was at a checkpoint, and there was a translation issue. A woman was not understanding that she was supposed to stop, and he was ordered to fire, and he fired on her and killed her. And as she dropped to the ground, she had a white flag coming out of her coat, and she was just trying to get information about a detainee. And so that's a second realm of objection, is objection to the killing of innocent people.
Those soldiers who come to believe the war in Iraq is unjust and seek exemption from duty there are only a minority of all the conscientious objectors. But, as Michael explains, they face a jail sentence for their belief, rather than the chance of an honourable discharge.
Interestingly, is there is a soldier, Lieutenant Aaron Watata, an officer who is facing up to 6 years in prison because he refused to deploy, basically on the grounds that this was a war, an illegal war, a war that was not being waged by the right authority. It's interesting. He's saying the very things that Kofi Annan said and even the very things the Vatican said, and the U.S. military is court-martialing him, and he's facing up to 6 years in prison.
But just how tough is it for a soldier to apply to become a conscientious objector? A stance that is often seen as the mark of a coward and the betrayal of a soldier's duty to fight for one's country. Michael again.
It is very difficult for them. And in fact, what we find is that probably well over half of the people who contact us don't actually follow all the way through with the application for conscientious objection because of precisely those pressures. They're called a coward. They're told even, now this is what's really troubling as a Catholic, they are told often by their chaplains, by military chaplains, well, you know, the war's on, so time for talk of conscientious objection is over. Well, that's just not the Church's teaching. The Church teaches that a soldier has a right in conscience to refuse participation in a war in general, or even in a particular act in war that they deem contrary to the moral order. So it is hard, but I must say sometimes Catholic chaplains are not helpful in supporting these guys and what the Church teaches.
Could this be because pacifism is not a dogma as such of the Catholic Church, even though, as you say, some individual Catholics are pacifists or become that way because of their experience under arms?
I think you are correct that pacifism is not a dogma of the Church. In fact, I mean, one of the things that we say, our organization, the Catholic Peace Fellowship, we're a very traditional Orthodox in terms of our doctrines. We're very Catholic. And one of the things we say is we actually don't like the term pacifism. We prefer the term that the early Church used for pacifism, which was called Christianity. But we do have this just war teaching, but it's important to know that, you know, Catholics can, as you mentioned, Catholics can legitimately, based on their experience, reject the use of all violence, or they can adhere to the just war teaching.
Michael says both Pope Benedict XVI and his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, provided clear moral leadership when it came to the debate over whether it was right to go to war in Iraq.
The Vatican has been brilliant and excellent, in our view, in standing up to the aggressive foreign policy of the United States. However, in the United States, what many, many war supporters are saying is this. They said, well, the Vatican has said no to the war, but has said nothing about individual soldiers. John Paul II and the present Holy Father have been prophetic on the question of this war.
And it was his faith that played a key role in Joshua Castile's decision to become registered as a conscientious objector. Joshua served in the Iraq War for 7 months and worked as an interrogator at the notorious Abu Ghraib jail just after the scandal broke involving the torture of Iraqi detainees there by US troops. He told me how the abuses he saw and heard about whilst he was there helped prompt him to reject his role in the military, a move that was also linked, he said, to his decision to become a Catholic.
I had about 133 combat interrogations at Abu Ghraib, and I was a part of the unit that was sent there to clean the place up. It was after the scandal had broken. And so we were doing things very, very particularly. We were interrogating under the watchful gaze of cameras and visiting dignitaries because they wanted to make sure that torture was no longer happening at the prison. But when that happened, all of the dark activity went elsewhere. And I have friends who interrogated for mobile interrogation teams for the Marine Corps and for special forces. And they were torturing quite regularly. They were stripping men naked during winter, pouring ice cold water over them, and then putting them in front of air conditioning units to keep them hovering over hypothermia. People were getting their hands smashed with hammers, baseball bats being, you know, smashed into their shins. And all of this was happening before and after Abu Ghraib, and well before and after, you know, Donald Rumsfeld said that we were abiding by the spirit of the Geneva Conventions. So this was happening while I was doing, like, the so-called nice interrogations.
So what was the actual moment when Joshua realized that a career as a soldier was not for him?
It's almost like a religious conversion where things slowly build, and you realize you have been a conscientious objector for years. You've been opposed to what you've been doing for so long, and that's why you haven't been able to sleep at night. But now it's time to move forward and to actually to shape your life upon a new doctrine. And for me, that happened while interrogating a Saudi Arabian jihadi. He was 22 years old, and he'd never fired a gun in his life. He was an idealistic kid from Saudi Arabia whose cousin had died while fighting in Iraq, and he came in to do his duty, to come in and fight. His understanding of jihad was almost synonymous to just war theory. It was simply, there is an aggressor in a Muslim land. It is the duty of the Muslim man to defend the lands. And we started talking about ethics and the cycle of vengeance. And I asked him why he came to Iraq to kill. And then he asked me why I came to Iraq to kill. And I said, I didn't come here to kill. I came here because it was my duty, which was very similar to his own circumstances. By this time, he knew I was a Christian, but he said to me, you know, you don't follow the teachings of Jesus to love your enemies and to pray for those who persecute you and to turn the other cheek. And I told him I thought he was right, that I was a complete contradiction. And so I terminated the interrogation, and I went back to my chain of command, and I said, I can't interrogate this guy any longer, because if I go back in that room, all I'm going to see is a young man in search of answers, and I'm not that much different than he is. Because I'm a young man searching for answers, and all I'm going to want to do is talk to him about ethics and the cycle of vengeance, and I'm going to want to share with him the gospel of Jesus Christ. But that's not my job as an interrogator. So if you want to get information out of him, you're going to have to find somebody else.
Even after that difficult decision has been taken to apply for conscientious objection, the person in question often faces strong disapproval from his family and friends, as Joshua found out.
You know, I come from a military family, and there are people within my extended family that thought that I was a traitor, that thought that I was siding with the enemy, or I'd become some sort of, you know, liberal, you know, nut or something, and they couldn't really see the degree to which this was founded upon my Christianity.
A significant proportion of the conscientious objectors Michael is coming into contact with are highly traumatized by their experiences in Iraq. What is especially alarming, he says, is that instead of being treated for their emotional wounds, they are often being redeployed by the military.
We are seeing a dramatic increase in post-traumatic stress disorder. In 2004, one of the most respected medical journals in the United States, the New England Journal of Medicine, published the Hogue Report, and this team of doctors found that about 1 in 5 Iraq war vets are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, it's interesting that about that same number also report having been involved in civilian deaths. What we are finding is that more and more soldiers are coming back, and they are showing great signs of stress. But the problem is they're being redeployed. And so we're going to have a wave of young men and women who are going to come back and who are coming back in great need. These are young souls who are scarred and know what it means to kill another person and trying to recover from that. And so that's why the church's No to War, which is so strong coming from John Paul II and Benedict XVI, church's No to War needs to be more than a political no. It needs to be a personal no. This is an area where the church needs to reach out. So many people in this country will say, I want to support the troops, but I do not think that we are ready as a nation nor as a church to really tend to the wounds of war that are going to be very evident in years to come.
That was Michael Griffin of the Catholic Peace Fellowship. And you also heard the voice of Joshua Castile, a Catholic and conscientious objector. And I'm Susie Hodges.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.